Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
The interesting thing is, you know, having taught these students for many years, they feel pretty powerless and ground down in their own way. I mean, they're going to go on to have often scintillating lives in lots of ways, but they also feel like they don't have a lot of choice. There's a kind of zero-sum game in which they participate in. But if they don't catch the brass ring, they're not going to be able to lead the kind of life that they want to lead. And in many of these cases, for example, I teach in political science, so I have a lot of students who go on to study the law, to go to law school, and they end up working incredibly long hours, especially if they want to work for one of the bigger law firms in one of the major cities in the United States. They have very little time for family life. They have very little time to do the great and noble things that they might have initially wanted to do, thinking about changing the constitutional law and so forth. Very few people get to do that. Mostly what they're going to be doing is working with clients and building up chargeable minutes and spending long, long hours in the office. So I think we ought not to illusion ourselves that there's a kind of power and empowerment that comes with simply acquiescing to the form of what we think of constitutes power, that in many cases you can end up in a condition in which you actually have relatively little actual.
Liberalism created the conditions and the tools for the ascent of its own worst nightmare, yet it lacks the self-knowledge to understand its own culpability. The sobering words of American political scientist, writer and teacher Dr. Patrick Deneen from his latest book, Why Liberalism Failed, published by Yale University Press. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. What is liberty? And has liberalism failed because it has succeeded? Well, on tonight's show, we're going to tackle those questions with American political scientist Patrick Deneen, whose latest book, Why Liberalism Failed, has been sending shockwaves across international liberal democracy systems. Where Patrick writes, "Our carbon-saturated world is a hangover of a 150-year party in which, until the very end, we believed we had achieved the dream of liberation from nature's constraint." Patrick goes on to state, "Liberalism's success today is most visible in the gathering signs of its failure. It has remade the world in its image, especially through the realms of politics, economics, education, science and technology." So has the great liberal project failed us, and what is a post-liberal alternative?
Hello, my name is Patrick Deneen. I am an associate professor at the University of Notre Dame. Previously, I held academic positions in political science at Princeton University and Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. I've written a number of books with an interest in political philosophy, the history of political thought, and democratic theory. My most recent book is called Why Liberalism Failed, published in January by Yale University Press, which has the thesis that the political system we've all become accustomed to in the West, liberal democracy, is in certain respects failing because it's succeeding. And so in some ways, its crisis is unfolding in some respects due to its own nature and its own internal dynamics.
Really well done on the book, Patrick. I have to say it was an expansive read, yet it was also quite compact in another way. But your argument is really well put together, and I must commend you on that. I might throw you a big wide open question to kick things off, and shall we can play it by ear from there. I'm going to throw you a quote from British philosopher and writer John Stuart Mill, if that's okay. Mill once said that conservatives are not necessarily stupid, but most stupid people are conservatives. Do you agree with that?
I always found it to be a very condescending observation on John Stuart Mill's part. I suppose you asked me that because I probably have the vibe of being a conservative, and there's certainly a part of my thinking that's quite conservative. And so it won't surprise you perhaps to hear that I disagree with that claim. Although I would modify it in a certain way. I would say that it's certainly not the case and I would agree that conservatives are not necessarily stupid, and in fact, I would say that in the modern academy, it's often the case that the more conservative you are, the more you're frequently challenged, your perspective is challenged. And so you have to, in certain respects, sharpen your mind constantly, whereas if you're more on the left side of the political spectrum, the more comfortable you are. So in an interesting way, in the academy today, it's actually our conservative students and arguably our faculty who are often the best arguers because they're constantly being confronted. But Mill's second point that most stupid people are conservatives, I would put that differently, which is that there's a connection, I think, between a kind of intuitive conservatism, a kind of desire to preserve a certain way of life, and let's say a relatively more settled way of life that doesn't promote the idea of frequent mobility and upward mobility and constant change. And so you could say in some senses, one of the defaults of liberal society is to promote a highly mobile society, constant change, constant progress, constant alteration of the way of life. And so that it's not necessarily stupidity that makes people conservative. It's a disposition to preserve a certain way of life. From Mill's perspective, however, that looks stupid. But I would disagree with that characterization.
So what does a good society look like to you, tell me, Patrick?
Well, yeah, of course, all human societies are always imperfect. And maybe we can say that all societies are necessarily always going to have faults in them. And I suppose part of writing this book wasn't an attempt to be an exercise in nostalgia, but an effort to say and raise the question of if there's a next, what's next? And I conclude the book by suggesting that we have to appreciate the achievements of the liberal political order while being aware of its own sort of self-destructive tendencies. And some of those tendencies I would point to as being massive concentrations of power, both politically and economically, in ways that would have made tyrants of old green with envy, that the sort of straddling structures of the modern state and the increasing concentration of economic power, it seems to me a real deep and profound structural challenges for the continuity of liberal society. And so I would say that as a start toward a better society, we would see a kind of decentralization of both political and economic power, which is it's an interesting question of how you would do that. And I don't have a roadmap from A to B. So just speaking in kind of a utopian form, a kind of decentralization of power that would, I would think, in certain ways, lead to an interesting form of empowerment of individuals in a society and a polity and in the economy today, in which people feel at once freer than ever, but also in some ways more powerless than ever.
Your book has been described as disruptive. I'm just wondering, how do you feel about that? Because clearly you believe we need a lot of global change in leadership and in terms of our overall direction, in terms of bridging the gaps between rich and poor and, you know, all the inequalities within the system. I know you touch on education and climate change and lots of different challenges facing all leaderships. But I'm just wondering, was that your stated aim, you know, when you set out to write the book, to be disruptive?
I suppose so. I mean, it's, with a title like mine, I suppose I can't deny that charge. On the one hand, I think people have read the book, particularly in light of very recent political events. Obviously, the election of Donald Trump, Brexit, things that are happening, particularly in Eastern Europe. And I should say, this is a book I've been thinking about, or certainly ideas I've been thinking about for well over a decade. And so, I can't say as I foresaw any of this specifically, although I'm not surprised by what we're seeing in our political world. But I meant it to be disruptive in the following sense, that I think particularly when you work in a university today or you work in the kind of intellectual realm, one's task is often to try to solve the specific problems or to see problems that we might be facing as fixable within the sort of systemic norms that we take for granted. In other words, that we have this fishbowl we swim in, and we think about changing the pH levels, in a sense. But what we don't think about is whether, in fact, the water is simply bad, whether we need to actually change the water or change the fishbowl, that we work within a kind of paradigm of liberal democracy. And if the book is disruptive, it really is an effort to raise the question, are we at the end of history, right, to use Francis Fukuyama's old phrase. His claim was that liberal democracy was the final end station of political development, that there was no further sort of possibility of any other political form after liberal democracy. And my book is an effort to raise the question, well, what if that's not true? And what if, in fact, the kind of deep, it seems to me, profound and systemic challenges we face today are not in spite of liberal democracy, but in many ways because of liberal democracy?
Patrick, you argue in your introductions that the greatest current threat to liberalism lies not outside and beyond liberalism, but within it. I thought that was very interesting, but I'm wondering would certain leaders actually recognise that currently?
Well, it is. It's interesting. I've been surprised. The book has received a lot of attention, not only within the United States, but internationally. Obviously, we're speaking today. And I think it reflects, certainly among the most thoughtful political leaders, it reflects among thought leaders, we could say, those people responsible for the sort of media reflections. It does reflect a felt sense of crisis within these circles. And I've been contacted by a number of political leaders and actors, both in Washington, D.C., as well as in London. I'll be traveling to London later in the spring to speak to some members of Parliament. There's a real concern, I think, about the systemic health of liberal democracy, and an interest, I think, in thinking through, are there things that can be done at the level of sort of everyday policy that might forestall or at least possibly act as a kind of corrective to some of these tendencies? Now, my book wasn't specifically written for political actors. Interestingly, I'm an academic, and I kind of wrote this book for future John Locke's and future Jean-Jacques Rousseau's. That this book was really written as an effort to think anew about our political nature and about, broadly speaking, the basic foundations of political society. So, in the end, I mean, I'm very happy to speak with these political actors, but I don't see the book narrowly as kind of a prescription for certain kinds of directions in policy.
I loved your passages with Wendell Erdman Berry, the American novelist and environmental activist. He's had a lot to say about community and social disintegration, hasn't he? And in terms of how we're all living and understanding the world.
Yeah, in fact, I think the most gratifying aspect of the book to date is I received a very nice note from Wendell Berry just recently commending me for the book. And that to me was any harsh reviews are erased by praise by Wendell Berry, whose work I've long read and admired and benefited from. Berry, if your listeners aren't familiar, Wendell Berry is an American farmer, author, activist. He writes novels, poetry, essays. He works and lives in a kind of very rural part of Kentucky. And he's a great defender of the virtues of small life, small town life, communal living. I suppose something familiar in Ireland, still an extensively rural country, with, of course, great pockets of urban concentration, the likes of Dublin. And what Berry really seeks to do, I think, is to appeal, especially to those people who are living in the great urban centers, to think of and sympathize with and identify with the people who are in the rural places and the ways of life that are necessary in some ways to maintain our own lives, especially through farming and through through a way of life that is often very conservative, that often is seeks to pass on a way of life from one generation to the next, and to call to our minds the disruption, especially that sort of, we could say broadly speaking, modern liberalism, the modernity itself, the disruption, especially that industrialization and kind of highly, let's say, highly managed and managerial forms of farming has brought to the countryside and to the land in ways that are actually proving to be very destructive of the very sources of our sustenance. So Berry is really seems to be one of the great prophets in that very old sense, somebody offering a kind of warning to those of us who may be living in a certain amount of complacency about our station, about our situation, disconnected from those places from which we just don't think about the sources of our sustenance, and calling to mind the need for us to be sympathetic with it, to be indeed in many ways supportive of a way of life that may be very opposite to our own. It goes back to your first question about John Stuart Mill, right? That if we simply regard rural people as stupid, we're actually in some ways insulting the people who provide us with the deepest forms of our own sustenance.
Is the development and the intense development of cities and possibly within that technology and all the infrastructure that goes with that, do you think that has maybe contributed to the marginalisation of not just rural areas, but kind of country and lived voices from the country?
I have a chapter in the book on technology, and what I really try to articulate there is that we often think of technology, and especially in the form today of the internet, increasingly the technology of things, the ability to control things from a distance, really the effort to sort of eliminate space that exists between people, right, through electronic media. But what Barry would point out, and what I would point out, is that, you know, farming is a technology, right? We've always had technology. There's all kinds of technology. There are technologies that are not disruptive, that seek to sort of preserve a certain way of life. So that it's not really a question of technology itself, because we are technological creatures. We couldn't live, we couldn't survive without technology. We're tool-using creatures, and we're language-using creatures. All of these are technologies. The question that I try to raise in that chapter is, how is it that we are predisposed to use technology, and how is it that we are likely to deploy technology? And here I rely on a number of authors like Sherry Turkle, who's written a book called Alone Together, Nicholas Carr, who's written a book called The Shallows, a number of essays, Stephen Marché, who wrote a book called wrote an article called Facebook is Making Us Lonely, which emphasized the way, particularly, that technology that we deploy conforms to a deeper liberal political technology, which is especially oriented toward the liberation and separation of self from others. And so that our technology, the way that we use our technology, conforms to our political technology, if I can call it that, and that it is oriented to assisting in the realization of the liberated, free, autonomous, choosing, self-making individual that lies at the heart of the aims and ambition of liberal democracy.
You cite that over 70% of Americans today, Patrick, believe that their country is moving in the wrong direction, and half the country believe its best days are behind it. And you argue that, you know, most institutions of government are showing declining levels of public trust. And you talk about, you know, the problem of corrupt elections and so on. Some people would see that as a little bit grim and somewhat hysterical and very, very negative. What do you say to that?
Right. I suppose so. Although, I don't know, when you have 70% of the country, at least the United States, saying the country's going in the wrong direction, and I wonder if that hasn't gone up since that survey was undertaken maybe a year or two ago. It may be hysterical, but it seems to reflect a deep, deep form of misgiving and anxiety broadly across the nation. You know, the level of trust in the United States, and I assume that it's pretty similar in Europe today, the level of trust, especially toward public institutions, you know, the kind of not only institutions of government, but across the board, the media. We saw the lowest levels of people tuning in to the Oscars, so a kind of lack of interest in Hollywood, or declining interest in Hollywood. The Hollywood is no longer sort of seen as representing America, but is in some ways a kind of elite set of voices that no longer reflect the views of the broad public. And, you know, we could keep going down the line that in institution after institution, in a democratic society, so we could say ultimately institutions that are somehow connected to the people and derive their legitimacy from the people, nevertheless no longer seem to have the confidence of the people. And here again, we could really point to the government as the key institution in which people have lost confidence, even though they are at least nominally in charge. And I think it's that idea of being nominally in charge that does reflect the idea that somehow if the elections aren't outright corrupt, and I don't mean to suggest, and I don't think I do suggest that they're corrupt. It's more that the sense that no matter who's voted into office, that there's always a kind of permanent government in places like Washington, D.C., or in Brussels, or in the nations, in various capitals across the world, the developed West, that there's a permanent government that sort of operates constantly without regard necessarily to the popular will and popular control. In the United States today, 7 of the 10 wealthiest counties in America are in or near Washington, D.C. Yeah. And if we think about it, Washington, D.C. doesn't really produce anything. It's not a manufacturing city. It's not the financial capital of America. It's not New York City. And yet 7 of the 10 wealthiest counties are in or near, right around Washington, D.C., which really does show the concentration of power results in the concentration of wealth. And I think in this sense, if one is not a wealthy person, the sense that one has very little voice politically and otherwise in the nation today.
And you could argue the same whether it's in England, whether it's in Italy, or a lot of different other countries in Europe, that whether it's the capital and the nearest counties around the capital and everyone else is eclipsed.
Yeah, that's certainly the case, that in the, I would say, more in the hinterland. Mm. There's really an increasingly sense, and this is striking, a sense that the government is an entity completely separate from the people. And so I live in Indiana. I used to live in Washington, where I was in the middle of the capital city and was very much struck by the enormous wealth and privilege of that city. And moving to rural Indiana, things are much different. And one hears constantly the people expressing the view that Washington, it's as if it's a separate country, completely separate from where the people are and the interests of the people. And again, if you consider that this is a democracy, at least in name, the idea that the government is completely separate from the people seems a fundamental betrayal of the idea that ultimately the government is us. It's representing us. It's a representation of the people. So something has gone deeply awry. And in the book, what I suggest is that in some ways the irony, the deepest irony that we're seeing come about as a result of, I think, the logic within liberalism is that the very freedom that is prized is indeed at the core of what liberalism is. Think of the word liberalism. It means liberty, right? It comes from the word liberty, libertas. That the freedom, especially the individual freedom, that we think of primarily in private terms, the freedom to do what we want, the freedom to pursue our own interests, is really ultimately purchased at the price of a kind of decline of a sense of common good and a shared civic life, the idea that we have a shared fate. And the more power that's needed to provide for us the opportunities to pursue our individual goods, to pursue all of the things we might want to pursue, requires a powerful central government and a powerful and wealthy economic system. But the more that succeeds and the more that we're individually liberated, the more actually it results in a feeling of powerlessness over the very tools that we've created in order to secure these conditions of individual liberty. And so the deepest irony and paradox, and it seems to me why we're seeing this crisis, at least at this political level, is the necessary and in some ways inextricable loss of control that the very form of liberty prized by liberalism itself seeks to achieve.
Do you think it could be argued, Patrick, that liberal democracy is rigged around the interests of the rich? Like, if you look around today and, you've talked about, declining rural areas and, problems in small communities and so on. And if we look at the educational system, if we look at, family life, if you look at some of the, the things that matter most in life, a lot of things are falling apart.
Yeah, it's certainly the case here in the United States. Of course, we have this terrible opioid addiction crisis, as well as just kind of the ravages of a decline of, say, a sort of healthy social fabric, marriage, childbirth within wedlock, kind of the idea that you can sustain a good and stable life within stable communities has really been lost in the poorer parts of the United States today. And I have going to have a chapter in the book called the New Aristocracy, which really focuses on this question. And one of the achievements of liberalism, indeed one of its main aims, was to displace the old aristocracy, right? Was to displace that old form of rule that was, of course, a hallmark of European society, the rule of kings and queens, and no offense to Elizabeth, but the rule of a kind of landed aristocracy that retained its position due to birthright, due to being born into a certain family. We could say liberalism was enormously successful at the displacement of this old aristocracy. But what we have tended to miss was that it actually proposed this displacement by proposing in turn a kind of rise of what we could think of as a new kind of aristocracy, or what we call today a meritocracy. In particular, a kind of, we could say, people of a disposition and an ability to live increasingly in a context of what in the book I call an anti-culture. Right? That one of the conditions, the ground conditions of this form of individual liberty is the decrease and the decline of cultural forms that tend to define kind of who we are as human beings, the kinds of individuals that we are, the kinds of traditions that we have. What shapes us as a kind of matter of an inheritance and birthright. So it's not only aristocracy that needs to be displaced. Ultimately, we could say it's an entire culture that needs to be displaced, or all cultures that need to be displaced, in the name of or in the purpose of achieving a kind of flattened, multiculture, in which the world is defined more by countless choices that we can pick this part of a culture, and we can pick that part of a culture, and we can adopt this kind of music, we can adopt this kind of food. But culture itself kind of declines. And there are some people who do very well in this anti-culture. And these are particularly the people who do well going to the urban centers, going to the top universities, living in a kind of a flattened landscaped of economic globalization. A form of placelessness is a very key aspect of the anti-culture. The idea of being in some ways defined not at all by one's place of origin or where one lives, but more as a kind of a human that can live anywhere and accomplish anything in those contexts. While the anti-culture is very beneficial for a relatively small part of our population, the loss of culture and the decline of culture has been very damaging to another part of our civilization. Here I would point here again to the kind of the rural people, the people who tend to treasure and value the old forms and the continuous forms of life that are passed on from one generation to the next. And it seems to me it's particularly the people who are not part of the new aristocracy who are bearing the brunt of the loss of cultural, we could say, norms and signposts, how it is that one comes of age and how it is that one forms good and solid families within stable communities. And the loss of those signposts has been especially damaging to those who are not part of the new aristocracy. So when you ask me, is liberalism created in the interest of the rich? I would put it this way. Liberalism in many ways is formed in the interest of a class that is likely to become rich and is likely to become powerful. And it's a relatively small portion of the population. And the deepest irony is that now increasingly they perpetuate themselves by birth. They marry each other. They produce children who have high IQs and are trained from the youngest age to be successful in the anti-culture. And so having successfully displaced an old inherited aristocracy, we've created a new kind of inherited aristocracy that perpetuates itself now in a way that is leading to a crisis of legitimacy of the liberal order itself.
Patrick, you argue the assumption by economic leaders seems to be that increased purchasing power of cheap goods will compensate for the absence of economic security and the division of the world into generational winners and losers. There has always been, and probably always will be, economic inequality. I'm just wondering, how do we change all of that? How do we change political systems? What are the alternatives? And how do we, have more kind of devolved power, if you will, and, you know, create local forms of government that are actually inclusive of all segments in society?
Yeah, sort of to pick up on where we just left off, one of the striking features of the new aristocracy and the kind of the differentiation, the economic and social differentiation of our classes today is that I think maybe for the first time in human history, we have complete geographic separation of the sort of successful and the not successful. So my suggestion is not that we're going to, in some ways, create a completely equal system. It would be better if it were more equal. But I think the idea of a perfectly equal system is itself a wrong-headed ideology. It was called socialism, and it didn't work all that well. And I think it doesn't work well for comparable reasons why liberalism doesn't work well, which is based on a false theory of human nature. The idea that we're completely individualistic is false, but also the idea that we're sort of completely egalitarian and that we don't care about that which is our own is also a false anthropology, a false view of human nature. What it seems to me is, at least in part necessary, is to think about, as a society, to think about the ways that those who are the most successful have a kind of a much more palpable and immediate sense of connection to those who are not successful. This was once called, in the old aristocracy, this was called noblesse oblige, the obligations of the nobility. And I don't want to romanticize this idea. You know, this is the idea of knighthood and the knight coming to the rescue of the damsel in distress, the idea that the powerful had an obligation to those who were not powerful. But nevertheless, it served as a kind of regulative ideal that could at least be invoked, and to which I think we could say that aristocratic societies failed to live up to. And I suppose you could say we have a version of that today, and it is, I would say, sort of left progressivism, especially among the wealthiest and most successful. I think that's our form of noblesse oblige, that we sort of, those who are most successful, vote in such ways that they believe that their policies will sort of take care of, government policies will take care of those who are not successful. But notice that there's a kind of breakdown in the way in which this becomes a kind of direct form of obligation. It rather becomes a mediated obligation, that we leave it to, sort of, in this case, government or some kind of public agency to take care of those who aren't doing well. But maybe it's not government policies so much that these people need, as much as they need, for example, people living in their communities with a lot of education and a lot of ability and talent who will open up businesses and will serve the communities and operate not only on an economy of profit, but also on an economy of gift, the kind of stewardship of communities that it seems to me that maybe was once more the case, certainly in the kind of communities that I grew up in, where the people who owned the businesses were also contributing in the form of sponsoring sports teams and parades and offering their services and their some of their treasure, but also their time to improving their communities. But if today so many of our most successful are simply sort of agglomerating in the urban centers, completely separate from those who aren't doing as well, we really do have a kind of form of separation that allows a kind of ignorance and that, it seems to me, perpetuates and indeed exacerbates the divisions in our society today.
I'm just wondering, Patrick, if we brought the likes of John Locke or Thomas Hobbes back from the dead, if that could be possible, and we threw him a copy of Why Liberalism Failed, what would you think they'd think?
Well, first they'd be amazed at being brought back to life. I think Hobbes would be, in many ways, not surprised by what he would see. Hobbes, of course, foresaw at least a political form in which you had very powerful central government ruling over highly individuated, separated, isolated selves. That's the, if your listeners are familiar with the frontispiece, the illustration of the Leviathan, that's the portrait. And in many ways, I think we live more in Hobbes's world than perhaps in Locke's world. Locke is a kinder, gentler version of Hobbes. Life isn't quite as harsh and nasty and brutish, and so you don't necessarily need the same kind of dictator. But I think Locke would also recognize a lot of this world, particularly Locke encouraged and foresaw the benefits of separating the people who would be economically most talented from those who would be economically least useful. And his argument was that the abilities and talents of the economically most talented would create a society and generate wealth that would benefit even those who don't do as well, those who are not as economically talented. And when you think within the American context, many of the reactions of my to my book have been exactly along these lines. They accuse me of accusing capitalism with generating these titanic inequalities that are leading to a kind of systemic form of illegitimacy. And what they will typically invoke is a kind of old Lockean argument that, in fact, that the kind of the social contract that we've agreed to is working, that everyone is better off as a result of great economic prosperity and the generation of great economic wealth. Even if it's concentrated in relatively few hands, everyone is still better off. And my response to that would simply be, maybe in the end it's not merely the economic condition that we're in, but the sense of dignity and the sense that we're a part of, in some ways, having a voice in the system. It's not merely that I get to have a flat-screen TV. It's the dignity of knowing that I matter and that my voice matters. And I think this materialistic explanation that you do see expressed in the like of Hobbes and Locke does not sufficiently account for, it seems to me, the needs of what we might think of as the soul or of the kind of the desire for dignity that even a very prosperous economic system may leave off the table.
Thank you.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with American political scientist, teacher and writer Patrick Deneen, whose latest book, Why Liberalism Failed, has just been published by Yale University Press. I asked Patrick about the debate on education and how some third-level educational institutions have recently come under heavy criticism for supporting and preserving the interests of the wealthy and the upper classes in society. I asked Patrick, how do we change all of that and ensure that our educational systems promise an uplift for all?
Sure. Well, so I've been very fortunate to teach in several of the top universities here in the United States, all of them ranked top 20 universities, very difficult to get into. So I've seen at very close range the tremendous kind of sifting work that these institutions do, identifying the most talented, the most ambitious, certainly students able to do what's needed, to get into these institutions. So, you know, capable of meeting the demands of the modern economy. I mean, this is really the kind of biggest demand that they face. And demonstrating an ability to do that. So I've seen at close hand the sifting mechanism that is the defining quality of, in many ways, of our education system today in the advanced West. You ask me what can be done about this, and in the first place, I would love to see more of these institutions doing more at the level of, in the first instance, being a little bit more open to having, I would put it, a lottery system in how we do at least some of our admissions, allowing in more people who are likely not to be exactly alike. And what's interesting to me today is that these universities are, overwhelmed by demands of and insistence upon diversity and the embrace of diversity. Yet the embrace of diversity tends not to include people who are not really the type of person who is inclined to go to a university like this. So we have lots of people of many different races, different identify with different genders and different nationalities, but we don't have a lot of people around here who come from farms and intend to go back to farms. And we don't have a lot of people around here whose life ambition is to open a small shop, a grocery store, and serve their community. In other words, we have a very single-minded viewpoint amid the supposed diversity. So in the first instance, I think it would be great to encourage forms of admission that would really genuinely have a lot of diversity. So we have very different voices about what constitutes a good life. There's a remarkable uniformity in these institutions that a good life is making a lot of money, doing usually something in the financial industry or in technology, and living in one of three or four cities in the world, New York, Washington, Los Angeles, London, and so forth. That's not very diverse. And the second thing we could do would be to encourage a certain amount of diversity, even among the students that we have today, in terms of how they think about their life ambitions. I mean, I get a lot of students who actually genuinely love the liberal arts. They really want to study classics. They want to study Greek and Latin, or they want to study English literature, Irish literature. We have a great Irish studies program at Notre Dame, you may know. We're called the Irish here. So we get a lot of students who have a passion for these subjects. But they find it difficult to pursue these subjects because of the pressure to go on to make a lot of money. And that's partly our own fault because we charge so much money at these institutions. So to encourage thinking about pursuing different kinds of and forms of what constitutes the good life may require us to think about, for example, if we have students who want to be school teachers, making relatively little money, we could find ways to forgive their debt, find ways to cover their tuition. Because they're serving a kind of good that it seems to me that we should treasure and value as a society. Not to say that people who work in the financial industry don't, but they're going to be able to pay back their debt.
But a lot of people, Patrick, would feel very powerless in life and feel that, you know, whether you mentioned, you know, like student debts and the cost of education, or they want to make change and they want to set up a small shop in a rural part of whether it's Ireland or America or wherever, that you need a lot of money to do that, or you need a lot of connections. And there, you know, a lot of people feel that they don't have either the power, the opportunity or the agency to do that. And they feel very ground down with all the limitations that the world is seemingly offering them. So what do you say to that?
The interesting thing is, you know, having taught these students for many years, they feel pretty powerless and ground down in their own way. I mean, they're going to go on to have often scintillating lives in lots of ways, but they also feel like they don't have a lot of choice. There's a kind of zero-sum game in which they participate in. But if they don't catch the brass ring, they're not going to be able to lead the kind of life that they want to lead. And in many of these cases, for example, I teach in political science, so I have a lot of students who go on to study the law, to go to law school, and they end up working incredibly long hours, especially if they want to work for one of the bigger law firms in one of the major cities in the United States. They have very little time for family life. They have very little time to do the great and noble things that they might have initially wanted to do, thinking about changing the constitutional law and so forth. Very few people get to do that. Mostly what they're going to be doing is working with clients and building up chargeable minutes and spending long, long hours in the office. So I think we ought not to illusion ourselves that there's a kind of power and empowerment that comes with simply acquiescing to the form of what we think of constitutes power, that in many cases you can end up in a condition in which you actually have relatively little actual power.
Patrick, you talk about android humanity and you cite some fascinating books which look at the evolution of technology and how it's impacting on not just society but on our minds, our sense of identity, our imagination, how we communicate. And in one way it's extraordinarily interesting, but it's also very, very frightening. And you argue we find that technology ends up either ruling us or destroying us. I'm just wondering, within all of that, could it be argued that we're all becoming a little bit dumber? Or has that been negative?
Right. So you asked me earlier whether John Stuart Mill was right. And it may be that it's, in fact, as we progress more, we actually, in some ways, make ourselves dumber. It is frightening.
But in terms of superficiality and how we're all communicating.
Yeah, I've written a piece, a separate piece, in which I appear to be lambasting my students for being fairly ignorant. They're very smart. My students are wonderfully smart, but they know very little because they've been given very little. They've been given very little in terms of a kind of cultural inheritance. They know very little about sort of what took place before their own lives. And I would say they know very little even about what's taking place during their own lifetimes. They've been given very little history, very little of the great literary treasures of our tradition. They're simply not familiar with sort of what's taken place before their lives and what led the world to its current condition. What's the story that lies behind where we are today? And I suggest that this is, in fact, this is, again, not because of technology. Technology has a hand in this. Certainly all the time spent on the cell phone looking at selfies and so forth is part of this. But I actually think this is, in some ways, you could say, a kind of systemic success of the liberal project, which is to create people who are without time. They don't exist in history. They don't exist in place. They don't exist in the natural world. I mean, part of technology is really to take us out of the natural world. And in all these cases, what this ground condition really achieves is the creation of this, again, individuated, autonomous, or at least seemingly autonomous, choosing individual self, shorn of place, time, and nature. This creature in this anti-culture. And what's in some ways most frightening about this is that it really begins to raise the question of what it is to be a human being. And if we are in some ways so much simply governed by, increasingly governed by, these forms of technological placelessness, timelessness, and naturelessness, why isn't it simply just the next step in some ways to turn ourselves into pieces of technology, to fundamentally dehumanize us, to the extent that we've been successfully deracinated, denaturalized, and detemporalized? Aren't we becoming more and more like these kind of creatures that we sort of imagine as this android humanity? There's this show right now called Westworld. You may be familiar with it. And the interesting thing about that show is how the androids, or these kind of machines, are actually more human than the humans who interact with them. What does that say about a world in which we find that to be a somewhat recognizable phenomenon?
So lastly, Patrick, what's the way forward in terms of what can we look forward to? Like, you know, will there be liberty after liberalism, you know, and what are these alternatives? And are there really alternatives? Because, you know, a lot of people would criticise what you've written and say, you know, that liberalism has opened up education systems, it has crushed dictators and despots all over the world, and it's led to greater transparency. And that a lot of people would sing the praises of liberalism. There's more on the kind of the plus side than the negative.
Whether that's a credible argument or not, I don't know.
Sure. Well, I think that's part of the reason there's a lot of interest in this book and more broadly in this question. We're seeing across the world today the rise of different forms of illiberalism. And the question before us is this illiberalism in some ways something that could be corrected by liberalism, or is it in some ways a result of liberalism? Does it arise from, in some ways, the kind of very conditions of liberalism? And my book is meant as a warning that the liberal political order is based on a certain set of assumptions that I believe is actually leading us ultimately to an illiberal end. And by illiberal in this sense, I mean really truly the loss of liberty, the loss of what of a kind of true sense of liberty. But nor do I think liberalism can ultimately promise true liberty, because as I've suggested, the ground conditions of our liberty as deeply individuated, autonomous, free, self-making selves is actually ultimately also a condition of a kind of bondage. And so the question on the table for us is, as you rightly say, is what is liberty? What is the aspiration of liberty after liberalism? And here throughout the book, I point to a kind of older conception of liberty, where liberty is understood as a kind of self-rule, not simply the absence of obstacles, but a kind of form of self-governance. And I mean this both in the sense of individual self-governance, the ability to limit our appetites, which it seems to me has a dire consequences for how we interact with nature and the way in which we think of ourselves as consuming creatures today. So the ability to govern our appetites as individuals, but also the ability to govern ourselves collectively. And in this sense, to think of ourselves in that old Aristotelian sense as political animals, not merely as apolitical or non-political animals that is posited in the liberal political tradition, but as political animals whose lives are fulfilled and indeed who create a good life together through a kind of common participation in a shared civic life, in the sense that we have shared fates. So this suggests really beginning to rethink some of the concentrations of both political and economic power, how we do that in ways that don't promote, you know, what we fear of that, which is just simply the forms of prejudice and limitation. I think we do have to take into account the successes of liberalism in opening up our views to the shared humanity and the shared dignity of every human being, but to recognize as well that to exercise our political muscles, right, to work on ourselves as civic beings requires the actual ability of people to govern themselves. And that means probably a somewhat more decentralized political system, certainly than we have throughout the liberal democratic West today.
And that was American political scientist, teacher and writer Patrick Deneen. Why Liberalism Failed is published by Yale University Press and retails for in around €30 in hardback. Now, I have to say hats off to Patrick. This is a terrific read. It's smart, pacey and hugely relevant to what we're doing and not doing today. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Okay, all that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Keith Thompson, who helped out with this evening's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the uplifting words of Patrick Deneen from his conclusions to Why Liberalism Failed, where Patrick writes, "The great proof of human freedom today lies in our ability to imagine and build liberty after liberalism." Too true. Good night. Thank you.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.